All right, we're going to continue now with Zechariah, the prophets of restoration. This is the 15th part of going through this. We're in Zechariah 9. We're going to do the whole chapter. So, the interesting thing. The first part of the book of Zechariah was comprised of a series of visions. And then in the last two chapters, we dealt with two didactic sermons, dealing with a sermon or two that was all designed to answer a particular question regarding fasting that in turn turned into a discussion of more weight, spiritually speaking, for the Jews. From chapter 9 on, there has been an ongoing dispute, at least for some time, as to whether or not Zechariah actually wrote these chapters. And part of it revolves around a quote in Matthew's Gospel from chapter 11 that Matthew, instead of attributing to Zechariah, attributes to Jeremiah. The higher critics want to tell us that this is not part of what he's done. There's no credible reason, however, for not believing that this is part of Zechariah's book. There's no credible reason for believing that Matthew miscites the Bible, nor is there a credible reason for thinking that he understood this portion of Zechariah to be written by Jeremiah. I'm not going to deal with all of that right now, but I'm telling you ahead of time, anybody who tells you that, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand what Matthew has done. They don't understand why he's done it. But I will point out why we have no reason to think or believe that he somehow intended Zechariah, but it just done slipped his mind. Wasn't the case. Now, what makes this different, this section of Zechariah, is this. Having gone through those visions, which were showing them what was to come in types and shadows, those visions were really, to a large extent, visionary precisely because they were taking in a lot of New Testament concerns. And so there's a lot more going on in the vision. The vision is more complex and admits of a lot more in the way of the texture of the message than, for example, chapter 7 and 8. Chapter 7 and 8 were a little bit more straightforward. It was a didactic section. Now in the prophecy, what we're going to be treated to here is a lot of what's going to happen. This is a really, in some respects, a bit of a timeline, explaining to them what's going to happen to them, to the Jews, to the nation, to these people who are rebuilding the temple, to the nation and people of Israel in times to come. That is, after the time of Zechariah. So whereas the visions were rooted in the time of Zechariah, these prophecies, and this is what makes them different, these are not rooted in Zechariah's time. These are telling them, strictly speaking, things to come. Right? And it's presented in a way that although there's language used that's meant to convey something, it's not the very heavy use of symbols and so on that you find in those first chapters of Zechariah. You know, you don't have somebody walking through myrtle trees and things like that, horns and things that seem almost magical going on. That's visionary. That's a dream. That's the way we construct things when we dream, and that's why these are visions. It distinguishes them. What we're going to read here is not like that. We're not going to be reading about things flying through the air, per se, as some of those visions. We're not going to have that real heavy symbolist use of symbols and so on that we saw earlier. So the things that are said here are a little bit more straightforward in the prophecy. It's a little bit more of a straight line, a telling of history before. This is a real case of prophecy telling history before it comes to pass, so that you'll know when you hit these markers, in fact, God sent this prophet. Right? Now, Zechariah 9 is very interesting, and as we're going to see, it takes them from the time of Zechariah, which is some 500 plus years before Christ, it takes them down to the time, particularly the time of the Maccabees, with a glance at the coming of Messiah, which I'm going to note along the way. We'll see that. But this is the first step in unfolding the history of the church. Now, what church are we talking about? That, I think, is an interesting question. In the visions, you have this idea of a move, for example, from Old to New Testament dispensation of the covenant of grace. In the prophecies, the people of God are going to remain. There's going to be a continual identity. But we're going to move right through the coming of Christ at one point. Right? We're going to see prophecy unfold in a way that shows us a continuity between the Old and New Testament people, because they're all the people of the covenant of God. And so, whereas in the other material, what's happening with the rebuilding of the temple is pointing to not only the coming of Christ and then ultimately the millennial temple and how that's going to, the millennial church, how that's going to shape up. With this prophetic material, it's more of a historical jaunt now to the point that was charted in the visions. The visions are telling us to look beyond this rebuilding of the temple, and even in a sense to look beyond the transition from Old to New Covenant, from the time of Christ when he comes in the flesh to the millennial church. They're moving along that. That's a visionary leap. But these prophecies are going to show us a little bit more historical continuity. In other words, prophecy now is going to show us that everything we just saw is rooted in history. And that's important. History is real. If all that we had were the visions, the idealists might be right in their interpretation of prophecy. You know, it might just be this sort of continual concatenation of recurring events in cycles. But these prophecies now are going to show us that history is real and it's linear. Yes, there are cyclical, recurring events and themes that take on an ever-increasing meaning. You know, each judgment is sort of piling on for the Jews and for everyone else until we finally get to Judgment Day. The people of God here then are going to be the same, so that when they're talking about the people of God, we're talking about the church that God spoke to at Sinai now. And that church is going to be the same church that's going to pass through into the New Testament dispensation. All right, verse 1. We'll begin with verse 1.
Zechariah 9, verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be the rest thereof, when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord.
Okay, so we're beginning at a period of time. Remember, the Jews have been regathered, at least in part. You read about that in Ezra and Nehemiah. They're rebuilding the temple. And now this turns to prophecy. And the prophecy begins with this word burden, really. So, in the Bible, when you hear the word burden, it's about as heavy a word as you can imagine, and it indicates that there's a threatening nature to the prophecy. This prophecy is not going to be comforting, particularly. It's a burden. It's a weight. I've got to get this weight. When you have to tell someone something you really don't want to tell them, it's a weight on your chest, right? And when you finally tell them, you've got that weight off your chest. Similar idea. Maybe even the same idea. Okay, so the land Hadrach, that refers to the kingdom of Syria. We have to remember, this is all in the context, and Zechariah is going to give us history in the context, beginning with some of the things that Daniel has staked out for us. Remember the four kingdoms in Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. Now they're back from the Babylonian captivity. Right? Babylon was succeeded by Medo-Persian Empire. So we have Cyrus, and then we have Darius helping them along in this process of rebuilding, regathering, and so on. They're brought out of this. Now, we're looking toward a time in the not-too-distant future from where Zechariah and the Jews rebuilding the temple are. And they're looking now first at the fate of Syria, Hadrach. That is a really... where modern-day Syria is, is where Syria was then. Although, at this time, it also included that portion of land that we would now call Lebanon. So it's all that land just north of where Israel is. And it's named Hadrach because of its idols. It's been named after its idols. And this is why judgment is coming. Damascus is the capital city of the land of Hadrach. It's a center of trade for Syria. So it's Hadrach is calling the name of the land of Syria after the name of the gods. And that's actually, that usage is in keeping with ancient usage, which we can see. And this applied both to Israel and to other nations. We can see examples of this. We look at Isaiah 8:8. And also Jeremiah 48, verse 46.
Isaiah 8, verse 8. And he shall pass through Judah, he shall overflow and go over, he shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of life of thy land, O Emmanuel.
O Emmanuel is, that's of course, the name for Christ, God with us. Israel's called by that name, Emmanuel. Jeremiah 48,
verse 46. Woe be unto thee, O Moab, the people of Chemosh perisheth, for thy sons are taken captives, and thy daughters captives.
Okay, so again, Moab is called after the name of its god in that passage. So this is not an uncommon practice. This reference that Damascus shall be at rest refers to the anger of the Lord, which was talked about in Zechariah 6:8. This did come out up in Zechariah 6, verse 8.
Zechariah 6.
Then cried he upon me and spake unto me, saying, Behold, these that go towards the north country have quiet my spirit in the north country.
Yeah, he's going to quiet my spirit in the north country. This is Damascus being, shall be the rest thereof, is the anger of the Lord, which implies this. These are judgments coming, but this judgment is going to continue in such a way that Damascus is actually going to remain until the time of the scope of this prophecy. And what is the scope of the prophecy? The scope of the prophecy, we're told here, is when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. In other words, the time is when Israel is going to be saved together with the fullness of the Gentiles. Then vengeance is going to fall upon the enemies of God and his people. So this prophecy is saying Damascus is going to remain until the millennium. And by the way, Damascus is, I believe, the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. But it's still there. Now, what this prophecy is about to do is it's going to begin following the conquest of Alexander the Great in the lands bordering Judea. So the Greek kingdom is moving from Macedonia toward the Holy Land. So it's coming from the north now, south. And you're going to see that language in this chapter. There's a movement. Now, again, this points out that this is prophecy. Because Zechariah is prophesying, his book is being written during the time of the Medo-Persian Empire. Actually, it starts with the Medes, but very quickly, he's actually there at the time of the Persians. Darius is a Persian. He's at the head of that empire. And this empire is going to come to an end shortly after this period of time. And Alexander the Great, the Greek kingdom, which Daniel talked about, that kingdom is going to go forward and overtake Medo-Persia. All right, so verse 2. Okay, and Hamath is a country lying north between Judea and Syria. We look at 1 Kings 8, 65.
And at that time, Solomon held a feast, and all Israel with him. Great congregation from the entering in of Hamath unto the river of Egypt before the Lord our God, 7 days and 7 days, even 14 days.
Okay. So Hamath is lying in between. And I inadvertently just. Cyrus is a Persian and Darius is the Mede. I flipped them in my head. I apologize. They're moving. This is going to come from the north south. Okay. And there's threatening that's being offered now for these people because they're really in the trade corridor, and this is a corridor that Alexander is going to take. So they're in the path of the invading forces that are going to be sent to punish. God is sending these forces to punish. Now it's very complicated at one level. What happens is these empires are going back and forth. There's a very complex interchange as the Greeks enter the picture, and particularly after the death of Alexander, which is talked about, or at least alluded to or presumed in this chapter. Okay, so moving south, the judgment of God is going to pursue the godless pride of Tyre and Sidon. When I say godless pride, Tyre's already been marked out, if you look at Ezekiel 28, verses 3 through 5, as well as verses 12 and 17.
Ezekiel 28:3-5. Behold, thou art wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that they can hide from thee. With thy wisdom and with thine understanding thou hast gotten thee riches, and hast gotten gold and silver into thy treasures. But thy great wisdom and by thy great wisdom and by thy traffic hast thou increased thy riches, and thy heart is lifted up because of thy riches.
Right. So we already know there's a prophecy against Tyre. We've already been told that judgment is coming. Remember, these people have been enemies of Israel for quite some time. And now punishment, they're going to be punished as the third kingdom supplants the second kingdom of Daniel. These happen to be, Tyre and Sidon, happen to be two of the richest cities in the world at that time. And Tyre in particular, is a very interesting city. It's a city that that is, first of all, Old Tyre is built on that land, on the land, on the shore of the Mediterranean. Old Tyre is a port. It's very well known as a trade port, a commerce capital. Very wealthy. So it's a, if you are an invading king, especially a guy like Alexander who wants everything, he wants to rule everything, Tyre's a good place to go if you need some money to pay for what you're doing, you need some food perhaps to support your troops, Tyre's going to be a good stop along the way. And the point of this prophecy is they deserve it. They've not particularly been friends all the time of Israel. Verse 3.
And Tyrus did build herself a stronghold and heaped up silver as the dust and fine gold as the mire of the streets.
Okay, what had happened over time is this. Old Tyre, the city of Tyre, was built on the land, but because of where it was exposed to invasion by the enemies of their prosperity. And anybody passing through is looking at that and saying, I can feed my army, I can pay them again, paycheck. So they were exposed and they got hit a lot. If you are familiar at all with all of the fighting, Israel is really, in one sense, put in a battle field. It's the battle zone. Israel is in a place wherever you're going, whoever you want to fight in the ancient world, you have to walk through Israel. Egypt wants to fight Babylon, you're kind of going through Israel. Syria wants to fight Egypt, you're going through Israel. They're always going through Israel. And along the way to Israel from the north, there's this city called Tyre. We can pick up some spoils. So what the people did, over time, is they got tired of this. And they decided, there was an island off the shore. And they decided then that they would they'd build another city out on that island. Now, during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the first judgment that was prophesied in Ezekiel falls on Tyre. Nebuchadnezzar comes through and he destroyed the old city, tore it down. And what the people did then is they took all of that material out to this island and they made a wall that was doubly thick, about 150 feet high, so that this island, this whole island, was an impregnable fortress. Tyrus did build herself a stronghold. And once Tyrus was out there, and they just had to trade with people on the land, then you take all the booty would go out to the island where they would hold it, because nobody could get to it, all right? That island became literally littered with gold and silver. is very wealthy. This is a very capital-rich target if you are a military machine moving. The problem is, it is a stronghold, and it's way out in the water. And people this time, A, probably didn't swim, and B, even if you could, a lot of that armor and all the gear you had to take, it would be virtually impossible to make that journey from the shore to the island. If you were to show up on a ship, there was no place for you to dock. Show up in a ship, all they have to do is throw some Greek fire over the walls, you know, something like that, and they burn you in your ship and your ship sinks. Nobody was trying to bother them on this island. Now, nobody except, read verse 4.
Zechariah 9, verse 4. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea, and she shall be devoured with fire.
Yeah, what's predicted here is the overthrow of Tyre entirely. Tyre, again, it was a naval base of the Phoenician Empire, and we're told here it's going to be overthrown. So about 200 or so years after this prophecy, around 332 BC, Alexander the Great begins the assault that's going to end with the overthrow of Tyrus. And here's what he does. Alexander, being Alexander the Great, there's a reason why we call him Alexander the Great, he shows up and basically stands on the shore and demands that Tyre surrender. And of course, if you're in Tyre, you think you're in an impregnable fortress, and you say, no, we're not going to surrender. This is ridiculous. What are you going to do about it? Tyre made a big and drastic mistake. Alexander decides that he is going to build a causeway from the shore of the island, and he uses the ruins of old Tyre, in fact, which is exactly what Ezekiel prophesies he's going to do. Look at Ezekiel 26, 4 to 12.
Ezekiel 26, verses 4. And they shall destroy the walls of Tyre and break down her towers. I will also scrape her dust from her and make her like the top of a rock. It shall be a place for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea. For I have spoken it, saith the Lord God, and it shall become a spoil to the nations. And her daughters, which are in the field, shall be slain by the sword, and they shall know that I am the Lord. For thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will bring upon Tyre Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, the king of kings, from the north with horses and with chariots, with horsemen and company, and much people. He shall slay with the sword thy daughters in the field, and he shall make a fort against thee, and cast them out against thee, and lift up the buckler against thee. And he shall set engines of war against thy walls, and with his axes he shall break down thy towers. By reason of the abundance of thy horses, their dust shall cover thee. Thy walls shall shake at the noise of the horsemen, and of the wheels, and of the chariot. And of the chariots, when he shall enter into thy gates, as men enter into a city wherein is made a breach.
So it's very likely that when Alexander was standing on the shore thinking, what am I going to do with these pesky Tyrians, that some Jew said to him, there's a prophecy here that tells you what to do. There's reason to believe that he, in fact, was informed of this prophecy and decides, you know, that's a good idea. And that has ramifications that we're going to see in a few verses. He takes all of this that they had left on the shoreline from the ruin of Tyre, and he basically, they start to drop it in the water. They create two dams, and then they start to fill it in so that they have something to walk out. They can walk out. They go out and they lay siege to the city. It lasts 7 months. And it was wave after wave. It was a brutal fight. The king of Tyre, they say, got up on the wall at one point trying to lead the people and was very valiant, and they all die. Okay, so when he finally gets in, they estimate he put to death around 10,000 people. 2,000 of them, by the way, he crucifies and lines along the shoreline to let everyone know you don't tell Alexander the Great no. He enslaved another 30,000 and he burned the city so that it was, like Ezekiel said, a barren rock where you can dry your fishing nets. He ruined it. Right. Verse 5.
Ascalon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation shall be ashamed. And the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ascalon shall not be inhabited.
Okay. So now we come to a place where various Philistine cities were going to be terrorized. This news is going to terrorize them, and it did, by the way. It did. The news of what happened to Tyre terrorized them because Tyre was known as the reliance of Ekron. Ekron was the northernmost Philistine city. So as long as Tyre was okay, Ekron felt they were going to be fine. There are five cities. It's called a Pentapolis that make up Philistia. Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, and Gaza. Four of them are mentioned here. Now, the destruction of these cities had previously been prophesied by Zephaniah. We look at Zephaniah 2, verse 4.
Zephaniah 2, verse 4, for Gaza shall be forsaken and Ashkelon a desolation, and they shall drive out Ashdod at the noonday, and Ekron shall be rooted up.
Okay. So this is a long time coming. Now Zechariah is saying, yes, this is exactly what's going to happen. Alexander's marching. He's destroyed Tyre and Sidon. He's coming. He's going to put an end to these Philistines. He's going to grind them. Remember, the Philistines are, again, the perennial enemies of the Jews. So Alexander's trek south destroys the cities. And in fact, what he does is so devastating to these cities, to this day, hardly a trace remains. They're out excavating, and what they find are ruins, real ruins. When Alexander got done with a place, it resisted or put up any kind of resistance or fight, it was ruins. The language here, the perishing of the king of Gaza, is talking about the destruction of the government with the subjugation of the people. And that's fulfilled. After a 2-month siege, Alexander comes against these people. And remember, these are not cities, these are not towns as you might think of. These are cities that are walled, like Jericho. Right? These are all fortress cities. They probably would have been thinking, you know, anybody who's going to try to fight Tyrus, they're going to wear themselves out. There's not going to be much left by the time they get here. It didn't happen that way. Alexander had the best day, and then he comes in full fury and destroys these Philistine cities. After 2 months siege, the governor, or king, we can see he's also called a governor. Look at 1 Samuel 5:11. You'll see a reference to these guys, actually. Look at 1 Samuel 5:11. The governor, the king, his name was Betus. He's dragged around the city. So, 1 Samuel 5:11.
And the ark of God was taken in. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel, and let it go again to his own place, that it slay us not and our people. For there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there."
Okay. So the lords of the Philistines, we're talking about the same, these are the When here we're talking about the king of Gaza, these are the same people. All right, they represent the same thing. This Pentapolis, these five cities of Philistia. This is Philistia. These are the Philistines. They've got five major cities, five lords of these cities, governors, kings, and Alexander comes in, boom, one of these guys gets dragged around. After 2 months of siege, he takes the guy and drags him around the city. This is how Alexander treats people who resist him. Right, Ashkelon, in other words, is going to experience the reality of the terror that's evoked by the news of Tyre's defeat. That's the point. Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. Just like Tyre. You were trembling when you heard what happened to Tyre. Guess what? It's happening to you too. Philistia, you're going to go down next. Alexander's coming south. All right, verse 6.
Zechariah 9, verse 6. And a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines.
I want you to think about what God is saying here. This is how he dispossesses. This is what he does to nations he judges. He's saying, your country is going to be possessed with strangers, a mixture of vile men, men who are base, men who have as little right to the land as bastards do to an inheritance. Remember the law of the bastard in Deuteronomy. Bastards can't inherit, and yet these people are going to dwell in your land. They have no right to it, but this is what he's going to do to you, right? It's a cutting off of the pride of the Philistines. Their external means of attack and defense are utterly destroyed. Alexander, again, five Philistine cities, at least four of them that we're talking about here, Alexander destroys them to the point the archaeologists today are looking for the rubble. It doesn't matter how great and flourishing these people are. If God has a controversy against them, it is sufficient to overturn their government. He's going to dispeople their country and put it in the possession of strangers. That's what he's saying. These are the enemies of the people of God. And it will not stand. All right, verse 7.
Zechariah verse 7, or 9 verse 7. And I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remaineth, even he, shall be for our God. And he shall be as a governor in Judah, and Ekron as a Jebusite.
Okay. So the point of this is that oppression is the fruit of their pride, right? They've oppressed people. And it's made them beastly. It's a beastly sin. They're like carnivorous animals, filling their mouths with the blood of their prey. This is an imagery that we see in Daniel 7, verse 5.
Daniel 7, verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said, they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh.
Okay. So this is what ungodly empires are like. They're like wild animals. Well, this is what God is saying to these people. I'm taking this out of your mouth, right? And what he's taking out of their mouth is his people. Ultimately, this prophecy, you have to understand, is a promise to the people who are rebuilding the temple, as we're going to see at the end. It's assurance to them that their labor is not in vain. The temple is going to remain until Christ comes. They're not doing this for no reason. So this abominable sin, oppression, is calling forth the just judgments of the Almighty. The enemies of the people of God are being shut. Their mouths are being shut. Blood is taken out. The abomination from between their teeth. Now, I want to notice this in this passage. Although there is total ruin of these places as nations and peoples, we actually have hope here. Remember the first verse. This is all with an eye to the time when Jew and Gentile are going to be converted and the millennial church and so on. Here we see afterwards some are going to be converted to God. The governor, the prince of Judah, expresses the national character of the conversion of those who remain after the judgments of God have run their course. In other words, they're not just going to be converted as individuals. They're going to be converted as members of nations to which they've gone, right? The conversion is actually illustrated by comparing those who remain among the Philistines to the Jebusites. Remember who they were? The Jebusites were those who were incorporated by covenant into the theocracy of Israel after they were subjugated by David. And so these people, if they survive, eventually there's coming a time when they're going to be converted. They're going to be brought in. Now, this prediction actually has an initial fulfillment in the time of Christ when multitudes from where? Tyre and Sidon come to Jesus. Look at Luke 6, verse 17.
Luke 6, verse 17. And he came down with them and stood in the plain, and the company of his disciples, and a great multitude of people out of all Judea and Jerusalem, and from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, which came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases.
So, again, the people of God are not the ones who are being cut off. God has an elect remnant, even among these Gentile nations now. We're seeing these people are all going to be converted and brought in, incorporated in. But God may be destroying Syria and Philistia and all of these other enemies of the people of God, but there are people from these places that are going to be brought into the church. Verse 8.
And I will encamp about my house because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth. And no oppressor shall pass through them any more, for now have I seen with my eyes.
Okay, so what this verse is now doing is very clearly, God is, through the prophet, assuring the people who are rebuilding the temple that it's going to stand. Despite what he's telling us about the coming of Alexander some 200 years later, he's saying, listen, despite destruction of Syria, the ravaging of Philistia, as he's marching his army through Palestine, Jerusalem is going to be kept safe. Why? Because God himself is going to encamp around them. He's going to be encamping around his people. He's going to be protecting that temple. Now, there are a couple of things that pave the way for the fact that Jerusalem survives. The first, as I noted before, is probably that some Jew shows Alexander this prophecy so he knows to build the causeway out to the island Tyre so that he can sack it and fulfill the prophecy. The second, and this is very interesting, as he's advancing on Jerusalem, and he is advancing with fury, he's not necessarily coming on friendly terms. Right before he gets there, one night, Alexander has a dream. And as a result of the dream, he stops and decides he's not going to destroy Jerusalem. In fact, because of the dream, he decides he ought to bestow great privileges upon it. And Jerusalem prospers as long as Alexander is alive. It's protected. God has protected Jerusalem. Now with that, the prophet takes a little bit of a pause in the next couple of verses. Look at verse 9.
Jeremiah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughters of Jerusalem. Behold, the king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation lowly, and riding upon an ass and upon a colt that fall of an ass.
Right. So now, what they're being told, this is really, even though this seems like an odd aside. This is kind of an explanation of why God stops Alexander. This is a parenthetical. they're being told that the temple is going to stand and that the Lord is going to come into the temple in the flesh. The theocratic kingdom of the church is directed to the coming of Christ the Messiah. If you want to understand why God is protecting the Jerusalem and the temple, it's because the Lord has to come into this temple. Now, this has been prophesied by other of the prophets, but Zechariah gives it to us a little bit different. This is why this is quoted, by the way, by Matthew. If you look at Matthew 21, verses 4 and 5.
This was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Tell ye the daughter of Zion, behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek, and sitting upon an ass, a colt, the foal of an ass."
That prophecy describes Christ as coming as a king, right? With his justice, that is, this is an expression of justice it's bringing him. He's in his kingly character. This justice, by the way, he's coming in justice. What's going on in this prophecy? The justice of God is paving the way for the coming of Christ in the flesh. He's destroying the enemies of the people of God, preserving his people and this temple for this event. He's coming in justice as a king. And yet, he's coming lowly. He's bringing salvation in the coming, we're told, but he's coming in a lowly fashion, and even his outward poverty, the outward poverty, his humiliation, is being noted in his riding upon the ass. Now here we're told the King of the Jews is appearing sometime, think about this, after the time of Alexander. It's being pinpointed. All these prophecies get a little bit closer and a little bit closer to telling you when he's going to be there. They keep moving it. Each time we get a little bit more of a glimpse, the timing, the precision of timing is brought out. We know from this now it's after Alexander. And really after the Greeks. Right? But he's not riding upon the stallion of a king, which earlier than this period of time, kings sometimes did ride upon asses. Samuel and people like that rode upon asses. But by this time, it was unheard of. A king would be riding on a stallion, a war horse. Right? Used asses at this time for lesser purposes. Horses had been introduced by this time for the royalty to ride around upon. And it was tied to the warrior mentality and all. All right, so verse 10 then.
Zechariah 9, verse 10. And I'll cut off the chariot from Ephraim, and the horse from Jerusalem, and the bow bow shall be cut off. And he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth.
Okay, so now we're told something else about Christ coming as king. So far from God empowering the armies of Israel, the chariot of Ephraim is to be cut off. Now, it actually had been by this point, but they weren't necessarily sure of that. But the point is, the Messianic kingdom is not to be spread by arms, and as God had cut off all the warlike power that the kingdom of Israel had, the Jews are being told that their power, their visible power, would be cut off before the coming of Messiah, and ultimately, for the rejecting of Christ, like the northern kingdom, they're going to be unable to help the spread of the kingdom of Christ. The Romans are going to take away the city and the temple of the Jews. This is looking forward. Christ doesn't conquer by the sword. He conquers how? What are we told here? He shall speak peace unto the heathen, to the Gentiles. Sound like a great commission, maybe? Go ye into all the world, to all nations. The extent of his dominion is held forth, which is the universality of the kingdom. I mean, here again, why do we think that this is going to spread through the whole world? We're told again here, the nature of the Messianic kingdom is spreading like this. Daniel's told us, every prophet And I've gone through a lot of this in our overview of eschatology. This is throughout the entire Bible. We see this again and again. The Messianic kingdom is going to spread. It's going to be everywhere. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that right now. Verse 11.
Zechariah 9, verse 11. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water.
Okay, so now he reels back to the time of the believers rebuilding the temple. And he's assuring them that they're going to be delivered during the troublous times. Any trouble between now and the coming of Christ, you're going to be delivered. The blood of the covenant reminds them that they're protected, right? There's covenant protection. At least for those who stay in the path of obedience, there's covenant protection. You're not, you're in trouble. The believing Jews, and this is what's interesting about this, the believing Jews, in fact, after the death of Alexander, they are, in a sense, cast into a dungeon, a pit without water, a dungeon is what. And that's when Antiochus Epiphanes, and Antiochus Epiphanes' time is from about 215 BC to about 164 BC. He is so horrible. He murders and enslaves thousands of people, goes into Jerusalem. This is after the death of Alexander. Remember, when Alexander was alive, Jerusalem was okay. Now he dies. The division of the Greek kingdom sets in, and Antiochus Epiphanes ends up at the end of a lot of maneuvering. He's the guy they're dealing with. He comes into the temple and he consecrates it to Jupiter worship. Now, had the Jews been presented with a gentle nudge to deform and conform to the society around them, they might have capitulated. But the result of a guy like Antiochus Epiphanes was these Jews had their backs against the wall and they doubled down on the faith of their fathers. And that's what brings us to the next few verses, to the end of the chapter. All right, beginning with verse 12.
Turn you to the stronghold, the prisoner of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee.
Yeah, turn you to the stronghold. That's saying when this comes to you, turn to God. Turn back. There's going to be a divine deliverance. And this is the beginning of a description of the divine deliverance the Jews are going to receive, because rather than capitulating to Antiochus Epiphanes, they pursue another course. They turn to God. Right? They're prisoners of hope. And the prisoners of hope during that tumultuous intertestamental period between Zechariah and Christ, and they're resting their hope upon the covenant. Remember? That's what they're told. They're resting upon the covenant. Now, to this is added a promise of their prosperity, that it's going to be doubled after they go through this afflicting experience that's been described. And that's what happens. Look at verse 13.
Zechariah 9, verse 13. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man.
Yeah. Antiochus Epiphanes represents the remnant of Javan, the remnant of the Greek Empire. He's it. That's what's left of them. And toward the end of the time of Antiochus, the Maccabean revolts begin. And around 166 BC, after about seven major battles, they achieve victory, and the first thing they do is go into that temple and rededicate it to the true God. And they establish a ruling party in Judea, which continues until about 63 BC. When Judea is made a client state of the Roman Empire. Right? So now Now we've got this idea, Messiah's not coming in until at least 63, what we would now call 63 BC. This is pretty well, they're going to be running the show. We know we're what's going on until then. All right, verse 14.
Verse 14, and the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as lightning, and the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south.
So, again, it's this verse is actually a verse, if you're a member of the house of Maccabees, you should be reading this at the time, because this is God saying, I'm going to protect you. You know, whatever you're undertaking, I'm going to protect you. You're going to win. The arrow like lightning, the whirlwinds of the south, and whirlwinds of the south are particularly violent storms. If you have Isaiah 21, verse 1.
Isaiah 21, verse 1.
Isaiah 21:1.
The burden of the desert of the sea, as whirlwinds of the south pass through, so it cometh from the desert from a terrible land.
Okay, so there, this is violent storm, right? The lightning and all of this is pointing to the fact that the army of the Maccabees is going to be resistless in their fighting against the sons of Greece. Thy sons of Greece. They're called the sons of Greece because these are the people who are descended from Alexander the Great. This is the end of the Greek Empire. It's, you know, it's happening. The Greek Empire is dissolving, and Rome is sort of getting ready. It's on the cusp over there, getting ready to take over from Greece. It's the fourth kingdom. The Greeks are not going to prevail. Now that, to people at this time, that would have seemed like an almost hopeless undertaking. The Greeks, Alexander, one thing, and remember Daniel talks about him as a ram and has this language about him sort of flying through the world, smashing whatever is in his way. He is... The Greek kingdom is the kingdom of the leopard. It's swift. It's powerful. It's predatory. It enacts its violence quickly. And it's over. And that's how Alexander, he moves rapidly. Alexander's rapid fire and continual until he breaks through. And he wins again and again and again and again. And then, of course, he dies. And it breaks up between his generals. And they can't maintain this. But they're still living in the shadow of Alexander. If you're sitting there in Jerusalem, and Alexander has died, and one of his generals, I mean, these are the people he was using before to great effect. These guys come in, they desecrate your temple, they're killing people, they're horrible. And then these crazy Maccabees, who are these people, come along and say, let's fight back. You're probably going to think you people are nuts. But God is promising them here victory. It's against all odds, except the promise and prophecy of God is with them. Otherwise, it'd be hopeless. And I don't know who would have undertaken that. Look at verse 15 and get a sense of this.
Zechariah 9:15. The Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones, and they shall drink and make a noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar.
Yeah, so the covenant people of God are going to prevail like a lion, really, over the Greeks, right? They're going to devour and subdue. And they're going to subdue, by the way, the Goliath of the Greeks. Like David did before the giant in his day. That's what that language is telling you. Remember David? Remember how Goliath, he was calling everybody out. Nobody could beat him. But you're going to win. You're going to win, and your sling stones are going to be laid on the ground next to his body. Next to these Greeks. The swords are going to be filled with the blood of the Greeks like the bowls or the basins of the temple. The corners of the altar with the blood of the sacrifice. Look at Numbers 4, 13 and 14, Leviticus 4, 30.
Numbers
4, 13 and 14, and Leviticus 4, 30.
Numbers 4, 13 and 14. And they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth thereon. And they shall put upon it all the vessels thereof wherewith they minister about it, even the censers, the flesh hooks, and the shovels, and the bacons, all the vessels of the altar. And they shall spread upon it a covering of badger skins and put to the staves of it.
Leviticus 4, verse 30, and the priest will take of the blood thereof with his finger and put it upon the horns of the altar of the burnt offering, and shall pour out all the blood thereof at the bottom of the altar.
So the language being used is very similar. You know, at all these sacrifices, they're collecting the blood everywhere. They're collecting the blood. And that's the language. When these Maccabees go in and they fight back, the blood of the Greeks is going to be falling and filling the land like the blood of these sacrificial animals fill the basins around the altar. That's what it's going to be like. And the victory that they experience is going to be intoxicating like wine. Probably a lot of hooping and wailing and yelling and cheering and jumping for joy as they were driving back those nasty pagan Greeks who were trying to destroy the true religion. See, again, remember, you have to remember, this prophecy is being given to the people rebuilding the temple. It's a promise. This is assurance. What you're doing is going to last as long as it needs to. The Lord has to come into his temple. It's going to last. It's not for nothing. It's not for naught. And against all odds, when a really bad problem arises that we now know as Antiochus Epiphanes, the Maccabees are going to be raised up by God. They're going to be blessed of God. They're going to destroy him. They're going to drive him back. They're going to rededicate the temple. They're going to reestablish a rule in Jerusalem, in Judea. It's going to last until they become a client state, 63 BC. 63 BC. All right, verse 16.
Zechariah 9:16. And the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon his land.
So God, we're told, God is going to give them the victory. He's going to be with them, and now it's assured. He's going to give them the victory. It's going to be, the language here, the idea is, it's almost as if a shepherd pulls his sheep out of the mouth of some wild beast. He's going to save them in that day as the flock of his people. Remember David when he went out and he destroys that lion and that bear? Right? Or Samson when that lion comes upon him. You know, that kind of language. This is particularly language of a shepherd. We move now then from warrior and lion or predatory language now to the language of the shepherd and his flock. Okay, war, and the reason for this is spelled out. This war is going to be followed by peace. It's going to become peaceful. The enemies might lie like a bunch of stones that were lying around Goliath, but the people of God, those stones that are scattered, are going to be like precious stones used to fashion the diadem, the crown. They're going to pick that up, and they're going to put it on their head, and they're going to rule. And that's, again, what the Maccabees do. They pick it up. Put it on their head, they rule, they run with that. They had been a subjugated people. I mean, they didn't know what this kind of independence was since they had been taken into the Babylonian captivity. I mean, even when Cyrus the Persian and Darius the Mede, when they're helping them, when they come back, when they send them back, that remnant that returns, they're not independent, not like they are now under the Maccabees. Now, this rebuilding the temple was not a vain endeavor. It opens up this possibility that we see going on here with the Maccabees. It would never have happened. Maccabees would never have revolted if there wasn't a temple. Their rebuilding of the temple is why the Maccabees end up revolting. They're flaming mad that Antiochus Epiphanes goes in and sacrifices pigs on the altar, dedicates it to Jupiter, the temple, tries to push his paganism through the temple. See, it's the temple, the temple, the temple. They're concerned about the temple. Well, if the temple had never been rebuilt, none of this would have come to pass. And the temple certainly wouldn't have been there for Christ to come into when he was incarnate. Like the last verse then, verse 17.
Zechariah 9, verse 17. For how great is his goodness and how great is his beauty. Corn shall make the young men cheerful and new wine the maids.
So here, this is wrapping up in this chapter, is the prophecy of the peace and prosperity that will characterize the Maccabean reign. Corn and wine, that tells us that there's going to be agricultural success. And agricultural success in the ancient world, you only have in peacetime. You know, when hordes of enemy soldiers are going through the land, you can't grow crops. You can't have a harvest. If there's anything ready to eat, they're eating it. If there's not, they may be burning it or destroying it. Ask the people in the South what it was like when Sherman went through and burned everything to the ocean. You know, it's devastating. This march of war is devastating. It leaves behind devastation. But the increase of young men and maidens also points to a time when wars and trouble are unknown. These people are prospering not only in terms of agriculture, but the population's growing. There's not a lot to happen to cut them off. So under the Maccabees, if you think about this, the tyranny of Antiochus Epiphanes aroused one family to fight back repeatedly against all the armies that had been sent by the Greeks until they utterly defeat that enemy and reclaim and rededicate the temple. And that's all part of the plan of God to keep the temple intact until Christ comes. So I think you might be able to take a little cheer in that. You only need two witnesses to get there. And we'll keep up the story of the advance of prophecy when we look at Zechariah 10.